Well, that was part of it. With the one hand, they carried out that program. With the other hand, they carried out the program of social services, which too stems back to the original Fabian thinking of the early years of the century. They introduced a social security scheme of unique comprehensiveness, covering all the population, as they said, first from the cradle to the grave, and then they improved on it and added from the womb to the tomb. Because after all, it begins with maternity grant. And with the other hand, they established what you will probably wish to ask some questions about, the Universal National Health Service, covering the entire population at every level of medical care. General practitioner, consultant service, hospitalization. You may have all your inside taken out by the miracles of modern surgery and put back again at the public expense in Britain. And that, I may say, means you, because this service is available even to the visiting foreigner, though a clause which is rather difficult, the administration of which must, I think, present some difficulties, does lay down that you must not come to Britain for the sole purpose of taking advantage of it. May I break off for a moment to say that there are vacant seats in front and there are people standing behind. I know that the prevailing culture pattern does not permit the front seats to be occupied. Perhaps we could break it for once. I hate to see people standing when they could sit. And may I also say, before I warm up again, that I have given a good many lectures in this country with a good many amplifiers, and I have never met an amplifier so beautifully adjusted as this one. I've met some which I would have been very glad to be relieved of. I appreciate that very much indeed. Well, that seems a good point for our pause, because now we have got our Labour government established for its first 5 years, busy carrying out its first 5 years programme. And then came, on that drizzling February day last year, there came the day of reckoning. And we had our second post-war general election. As you know, they were re-elected, but their majority fell from 153 to 7. And the American papers, amongst others, were full of articles, I thought perhaps slightly jubilant articles, about the swing of opinion. Well, there was a swing of opinion, but it wasn't quite as big as the results in the House of Commons might have led you to suppose. In the 1945 general election, we voted 48 Labour, 40 Conservative, and 12 for the odds and bits. In the 1950 election, we voted 46 Labour, 44 Conservative, and 10 for the odds and bits. So the difference, you see, the essential difference, was from 48-40 to 46-44, which is not an absolute reversal of opinion. I think we learned some things from that election. We learned, first of all, that whatever people may think elsewhere, we draw a very clear distinction between the kind of milk and water socialism that this extremely representative government that I have described likes to offer us, and communism, Russian style. We are told sometimes there's no difference. Well, clearly we thought there was. In this election, the communists, who are not a prohibited political party, put up 100 candidates for parliament. There was, by the way, a reason for that exact number. The British Broadcasting Corporation, which, as you know, is a public service corporation, arranges with the political parties the allocation of broadcast time in an election campaign. And they came to an agreement that any party which could put as many as 100 candidates into the field should have a period for radio talks. The communists put exactly 100 candidates into the field. And exactly 100 candidates were defeated. To rub the lesson home, we have, as many of you know, a requirement in law that if a candidate fails to poll 1/8 of the votes cast at an election, he must forfeit a sum of money. The intention is to discourage frivolous candidatures. Though why anybody thinks standing for Parliament is a form of frivolity is more than I've ever been able to understand. Well, of our 100 communist candidates, 100 were defeated, as I said, and 97 forfeited their deposits. But the Labour Party, with which communists are sometimes confused, was, as I said, returned with a majority of 7. We learned one other thing, perhaps less important. We learned, I think, that we are not capable of seeing anything but very broad, clear issues. It may be that we are a simple people, not very subtle. Sometimes you credit us with a great subtlety and iniquity. I've met that very often on this side. But maybe we're not quite as subtle as you think we are. We are perhaps simple. When our House of Commons was burned down during the bombing, we had to decide how to rebuild it. We wanted to be up to date, and we therefore discussed, amongst others, a plan to rebuild it after the fashion of the rest of the world, including, of course, the American continent. That is to say, to rebuild it not in parallel benches, but in a semicircle, allowing for every shade of opinion from the extreme left at one end to the extreme right at the other. But oh no, that's too difficult, too subtle. We decided to rebuild it old style, with His Majesty's government on the one hand, and opposite, on parallel benches, His Majesty's opposition, as we call him, on the other side. We could only understand the difference between two parties. And sure enough, when it came to the election, that decision seemed to be also confirmed. Because the Liberal Party, who had said in 1945 that though they might not do very well then, they were set for a long-term revival, and you wait until 1950, and then you will see. The Liberal Party fared very badly, the middle-of-the-way folk. They have, as you know, the middle policy. I think perhaps more correctly I would say the middle policies. For it is said now of liberals what was once said of economists, that wherever there are 3 liberals, there are 4 policies. They put up 478 candidates into the field, and 10 were elected. So we came back, you see, with the government very closely balanced, close balance in the country, close balance in the House of Commons, 2 simple parties cohering round 2 poles of opinion, and that, I think, exhausts our understanding. One or two other comments perhaps I might make on the position of the election. The Labour Party retained, as one would expect, the big industrial centres, where after all their strength always has been. They retained to some extent, but less securely, a number of the rural constituencies. The English countryside, it's fair to say, has been more prosperous in the past few years than for a very, very long time. Where they lost, and this is what tipped the scale, to make the difference between 1950 and 1945, where they lost was in what you might call the commuter areas, the suburban districts round the big cities, and particularly round London, where the middle, lower middle income brackets tend to live, and particularly white-collar workers and people of that sort. There is a political anecdote, or there was, when I was in London, going round London, which possibly illustrates the reason why. The story is told of a man who came into the local Conservative Party office and offered a large subscription. Caused a good deal of surprise, because he had been known to be a regular Labour voter. So the Conservative Party agent said to him, "How come that you who vote Labour are now subscribing to the Conservative Party?" "Oh," he said, "I always wanted to subscribe to the Conservative Party, but not till we had a Labour government did I have enough money." There is a moral in that story, and I will leave you to draw the moral. But I think there is quite a serious moral as to the strengths and weaknesses of the Labour Party. Well, now we have this government back again, and there are two questions that concern us and perhaps to some extent concern you. Will it last? And what will it do while it does last? Will it last? It could come to an end in a number of ways. It could come to an end, for instance, by making a coalition or bipartisan or tripartisan government. I think that that is unlikely, short of total war. In the event of total war, it's a very probable answer. We have always had coalition government. In the last we had, came to it in both the big world wars, and I think it's likely that we should sink all party differences in the event of another. But apart from that, I think it is very unlikely. There are a number of reasons. There are first of all policy reasons. A coalition government means harnessing two horses to the same wagon. It's fine if they both pull in the same direction. But it's not awfully good for the wagon if they pull in opposite directions. And we still feel, I think, that there are latent differences, perhaps, but real differences in the direction in which the Conservative and the Labour Party horse wish to pull, certainly on domestic issues. There are also, of course, some personal factors that it's fair to take into account if you're thinking of the possibilities of a bipartisan government. There is no particular reason why Mr. Attlee, who holds a majority in the House and still a majority in the country, there's no particular reason why he should resign. If he doesn't resign, you could only get a coalition government by having the Conservatives to contribute their members to serve under him. I think the picture of Mr. Churchill serving under Mr. Attlee is improbable. There are, in fact, personal factors. So I don't myself think there's a coalition coming. You will read in the press quite often that there is a coalition coming. We've read that for 5 years. And it usually comes from people who would like a seat in the government and haven't got one. It might, on the other hand, come to an end by defeat. 7 is not a big margin, and influenza is raging in London. The government has already been defeated twice, but on issues which were deemed to be so unimportant that even our constitution did not require its resignation. It was defeated quite early in its career when, having an adjournment debate on the subject of whether the House should go home to bed or whether it should stay and talk about some miscellaneous problems of the Ministry of Fuel, it went home to bed. It was defeated a second time on this momentous issue, whether the non-governmental members of the House should have the right to introduce their own bills and to speak to them for 10 minutes on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. They won that right over the heads of this totalitarian dictatorship. But it has not been defeated on any vital issue. I think it's unlikely to be defeated on any issue of foreign policy within the near future, and for a reason which I will elaborate in a moment. But it could be defeated on any issue of domestic policy, and that could happen any day. As I think I have already suggested, the question whether it happens or not is largely a matter of luck. 7 gives a very small margin. It could be that the influenza hits the government side of the House more hardly than it hits the opposition. We have already had the spectacle of members of Parliament coming from their sick beds, on their crutches, in their ambulances, on the one side to save the life of the government, and on the other side to bring it down. We hope at not too great risk to their own lives. But happily, we do have doctors on both sides of the House. And it could be that one day, for all the efforts that are made on both sides, the majority may lie with the opposition.